Linoleum Knife.
A podcast of the cinema.
What's your name?
I'm Alonso Duraldi.
Who are you?
I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap and co-host of other podcasts besides this one.
Several others.
Including Breakfast All Day, Who Shot Ya, a film and a movie, and now appear Mondays on Deck the Hallmark, reviewing non-Hallmark made-for-TV Christmas movies.
5 days a week, Deck the Hallmark, and you're on one day a week.
Correct.
And yet you're still working that Christmas movie brand.
You know,
on their show.
It's Manish, and welcome to it. Who are you?
Nothing. No one. From nowhere.
That's not true.
Dave White.
There you go.
From nowhere.
If you're going to go nowhere, baby, you got to go nowhere fast.
That is correct. I'm a film critic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
It's Super Bowl Sunday.
Don't care.
Don't care.
Don't care about that.
Nope.
Not something I care about. You know what I care about?
What?
Cinema.
Sure.
Do you know what the film... We're getting right into it.
Yeah.
This week. We only have like an hour. We can't dawdle and, lollygag and be lazy bones and the like.
Uh-huh.
We have to hop to it today.
We're not going to shilly shally.
I've got a chicken pot pie that's got to go in the oven.
Yes.
We've got things to do. Very important things.
Okay.
Oh, who are all these people out?
Is
someone having a Super Bowl party?
I bet someone's having a Super Bowl party.
Great.
Yes.
Great. A super spreader Super Bowl party.
So I'll be putting a fourth mask on if I ever have to step outside.
We're never opening our front door again. It's just, we're just locked in here for the rest of our lives.
Would appear.
The tumbling up the stairs that I just heard.
I know.
Yeah. Well. I know who it is, too.
No question.
I know exactly who it is, too.
No question who it is.
I don't even have to look out.
Nope.
I don't even have to do the bewitched Gladys Kravitz peeking out on the balcony thing to know exactly what's up.
It's that neighbor.
Three doors down. Mm. Yes. All right. We have two.
Two
films to talk about today. There are normally more than that.
Yes.
But this week, no. We were going to have three. The two films we're talking about today are Malcolm and Marie and Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time.
Yes.
That's a Hungarian film.
Yes. With a lot of title.
We tried for the second time to watch the Georgian entry for Best Foreign Language Film.
Yes.
It's called Beginning.
Yes.
It's about, well, we don't even really know.
It's about a wife of religious persecution. Yeah,
it's about a woman who's
Jehovah's Witness. And that's about all we could get to because the screener links kept crapping out on us. And when I say links, I mean we had more than one.
We had two different separate ones sent to us. Neither one of them worked.
Yeah.
We've seen 20 minutes of this movie.
It starts strong. I can say that much. I hear good things about it in general. It's been getting good reviews. When we get a Blu-ray or some sort of physical copy.
When something better comes along.
We will talk about
it. Totally watch it.
In the meantime, we have these two movies, and we're going to finally get caught up on a bunch of letters which have been stacking up like crazy.
Don't say a bunch. Say as many as we have time.
Well, as whatever we worked in.
We're going to fill the hour.
Okay.
After we talk about the two films.
Okay.
With letters.
Then let's get to it, shall we?
Yes, let's. Malcolm and Marie.
Mm-hmm.
It's from Sam Levinson.
Yes.
The director of...
Assassination Nation.
Assassination Nation. What else did he make?
And he created Euphoria.
Well, he created
the American version of Euphoria.
Yes. Yeah.
Which, again, no small feat. Like, you know, if you've ever seen the American attempt to do Fawlty Towers with B. Arthur, just because a show was popular in another country doesn't mean the American version is automatically going to take off. Believe me, the road to good intentions is littered with, you know, coupling and heaven knows what else. But every so often you get The Office or a Homeland or a Euphoria where it takes off. Off and it feels germane to the country, to the United States.
Explain what Malcolm and Marie is about, currently streaming on Netflix.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Malcolm and Marie is what the old timers in the biz used to call
a two-hander.
There's two people in this movie.
Sounds dirty, doesn't it?
It does. When you say it like that.
It sounds dirty.
Filmed during the pandemic, so they were like, hey, let's do a movie with only two people in it. And yeah. Those two people are Zendaya and John David Washington. And Washington plays a filmmaker who is coming
back. He's a hotshot young filmmaker.
Rising young filmmaker.
He's not just a filmmaker.
They're coming back to their rented Malibu house after the premiere of his movie. He's on a high. He's feeling on top of the world. Everybody's excited about this film. Marie, not so enthusiastic. Not so outgoing.
She's tired. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. She's tired. I understand this.
She's tired, but she's also like not saying something.
Right. Yes.
And then she says it.
Right.
And then we are off to the races. And this entire movie is basically these two people having a really major argument where all the stuff from their relationship that isn't being talked about gets talked about. Yes. Now, if it were just that, I think it might be more onto something. Unfortunately, it's also about Malcolm giving you his ideas about cinema and specifically film critics. And before anybody thinks that, you know, like we can't handle being talked about.
Oh, listen, I recently had someone nameless, someone who will not be named. Tell me that essentially that our jobs were bad.
Oh, right. Yes.
Bad. It's bad to be a film critic.
It's bad to criticize anything.
Yeah. And that because that's the person who said this to me, the word criticize came up again and again and again. And I said, all right, do you understand that that's not, I mean, do you understand that there's, you know,
more to it.
There's so much more to this job. It is in its best sense, it's like an academic pursuit, and the things you do in this job require a lot of preparation and study and
analysis.
The conversation went nowhere, but it's fine. Anyway, continue.
So Malcolm has issues with film critics, specifically one film critic who is referred to periodically by both Malcolm and Marie as that white bee from the Los Angeles Times.
Don't trust the bee in apartment
23.
Whatever. Yeah.
When I first saw the film, this just sort of rolled off my back. I assumed that it was like, you know, a composite. Only to find out that there is, in fact, a white woman who writes for the Los Angeles Times.
And we know her.
The very talented Katie Walsh, who coincidentally gave a not great review to Mr. Levinson's previous film, Assassination Nation. Mm. He denies that this is who's being discussed.
But
they say it a lot. And they are, and Malcolm in particular is very quick to sort of, you know, belittle any kind of insight that comes from this source. Eventually
more than that.
He goes to read the new review. And even though it's a positive review, he still has issues with everything.
It's F her.
Yes.
With a cactus.
Yes.
And I, well, continue.
That's not pleasant. And then also.
No, it's not just not pleasant. It's violent and misogynist.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the way that the scene is scripted, it is a black filmmaker specifically complaining about what white film critics get wrong about black film.
Yes.
Which is great and fine and good, except that Sam Levinson is white.
Yeah.
And that just lands weird
now,
for me.
Now, I don't know. You just opened up a conversation door here, so let me walk through it with you.
Okay.
I don't know who collaborated, you know, not in a non-credit getting way on this script. If the subject of race that comes up in the film and it does come up with some frequency, about what is the responsibility of a black filmmaker? What is the responsibility of a critic who is, you know, a white critic or a black critic, or, you know, is the critic a woman? Who gets to make art? And about what?
Right.
And who gets to talk about it? And this line of you know, back and forth between John David Washington and Zendaya comes up again and again.
Mm-hmm.
So the film throws out a lot of ideas, and these ideas are discussed in the context of two people having a fight about their relationship.
Right.
And so nothing is resolved in this discussion. It's a lot of like throwing culture ideas at the wall. Not just culture ideas, but ideas about race, about gender, about the nature of art, about what a film should be.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing gets made with it. It's a lot of, you know, pulling open a wound and washing it out and then ignoring it after you're done, you know, talking about all the stuff.
Well, okay, but then to go back to what we were saying before, though, you're saying that you don't know what input Levinson got from other sources.
I
would imagine then, like, you know, had, say, the cast or someone else
right.
had a lot of that input, then maybe a la Linkletter and the Before trilogy, you know, you credit them.
Yeah, well,
because
I don't know
if that. His name is the only yeah. one on the movie, we are forced to assume that he is.
I get that. So here's the thing. You have gone down some paths with discussing this film that I would say even the film thinks are tangential. You know, as critics, the first thing we notice is, hey, they hate critics.
Oh, they're talking about us.
What a surprise. Like, I don't know that there is such a thing in contemporary cinema as
a positive portrayal of a film
positive
critic.
Portrayal of any kind of critic. They're
true,
all
theater,
pathetic,
arts.
Sad, frustrated.
Yeah.
People.
Bitter.
They're bitter. They're failed artists. They are, you know, whatever the filmmaker wants to call them, that's
sure.
what they are. There is there ever an accurate portrayal of what this job means?
I've never seen one.
And what people who do it are like? I haven't seen one.
There was an Argentine film a few years ago called The Film Critic.
Okay.
That had its moments.
Haven't seen it.
Okay.
Now, does this offend me? No, I don't care. I think it's amusing, really.
Yeah.
Because it shows you that the person creating this cultural object, in this case, the film Malcolm and Marie,
mm-hmm.
has a very thin skin and doesn't understand the nature of this work.
Right.
But, you know, they've got a movie, so they're going to say the thing in the movie. Again, I don't care.
No.
If I care at all, it's that this fictional character is given the language of violence to describe what they would do to this woman.
Yes.
And that is what I am absolutely not okay with. But I think the film itself is meant to be more about the nature of this relationship.
Right. And that's where my problems come with it. Because like the critic stuff I can take or leave. I never think that anybody's reading my stuff. Like on those rare moments that I've gotten any kind of feedback from people,
Director X read
my stuff. Yeah, but generally speaking, I just assume they got better things to do. And so,
not the director who actually goes by the name Director X.
Right. No, this is an old story from the show about
secret,
I got a phone call from an A-list filmmaker with questions about things. Anyway. You know, I can, it doesn't matter to me. I think if anything, they're showing their, like you said, thin skin, if they're going to complain about reviews. Cause like in the grand scheme of things, like they like to pretend we don't matter, and often they're right as far as, like,
yeah, sure,
you know, making money or whatever other stuff is going on with the film.
Right.
But, you know, the thing is, like, yeah, I love a movie like this that's very intense, that's all, like, people, you know, like, having these emotional conflicts,
yes,
getting up all in there. And, you know, like, it's like, somebody said, it's like Virginia, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, but only half, you know, I mean, and that's a stretch, but it's nonetheless, it is in that general type of film. However,
it's certainly using Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as a template.
Guidepost. Yeah. Oh, for sure. No question. But I think that as the movie carries along, you come to find out that both of these characters are not nearly as interesting as they originally come off at being, and the source of the conflict between them winds up being a lot less interesting than what it originally appears to be.
I disagree with you about that.
Okay.
I think the source of their conflict is the source of conflict with lots of people, particularly, you know, if a couple is both, if they are both creative people.
Okay.
And they're working in the media or art or something, you know, like that. Furthermore, the idea of, you know, where does art come from and what can you take?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you allowed to take from someone else's life?
Yeah.
You know, in this film, John David Washington's character has taken Zendaya's character's background,
right,
as the source for his film. She was a drug addict. She got clean. And that's part of the film.
Yeah.
She's also an actress. He did not cast her.
Right.
And that's a thing that she's been sitting on for a long time. It's the nature of, you know, the artistic ego. And how does it need to be, you know, can it work in collaboration with anyone? Or must it keep itself going, must it believe that it is autonomous?
Sure.
I
think there are a lot more interesting movies out there that are about, like, the larger idea of the artist's responsibility, rather, to his muse.
I'm saying that the idea is a good one.
Okay.
The execution here is not so great, and this is a script problem.
Mm-hmm.
The performances,
yes,
are good. John David Washington is such a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
He can just move through a scene any old way he chooses, and he has inherited a version of his dad's, you know, magnetism.
Mm-hmm.
It's different from Denzel Washington, but it is no less powerful, and he's going to be, you know, someone that we get to watch their career go for the next several decades, and that'll be cool.
Yeah.
Zendaya, the same thing. She's fantastic.
Yeah.
I've watched all of Euphoria. She's amazing in it. She got an Emmy for that.
She was even good in The Greatest Showman.
She's the only person that I thought was interesting in The Greatest Showman. And here, she takes a fairly thankless, you know, role. One where she has less to say than the man.
Yep.
Again, this is the thing. We've talked about this before. But she walks away with it.
Yeah.
In spite of that.
She is very good as both a film and TV person at registering a lot in the subtlest way possible.
Right.
Like, the camera can be an inch from her face.
Yeah.
And she's always giving you just the teeniest little thing that is telling you all that you need to know.
Yeah, for sure. And when they are fighting at their best here, when they are, when they're angry and comic at the same time, the mac and cheese scene, you'll see it when you watch it.
It happens early.
It happens pretty early. But it is operatic comedy. And they go for the jugular when they fight. They don't fight fair at all.
Oh,
as a couple, they do not fight fair. Because they're young.
Yeah.
They haven't learned how to do this yet.
Yeah.
And you worry as you like, if you get invested in these characters at all, you worry, oh, they're going to break up because they don't know how to behave when they fight with each other.
Right.
They don't know that you don't just throw all the knives.
Yeah.
That you don't sit on things for, you know,
years
and let them fester. You address little problems as they come along. You talk them through. And so, you know, that's one of the more realistic and more pleasurable, weirdly enough, elements of the film. When they're fighting and they're doing it in a grand way.
Yeah.
Their chemistry together as these fighting people is, you know, it might not be insightful, but it is pleasurable.
Sure.
So I think what we wind up here with is a movie about two people who are trying to make their relationship work and who are encountering obstacles with their chosen fields of work and taking it out on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of it, there are these directorial intrusions where Sam Levinson clearly has axes to grind about, you know, who knows more about cinema than me, Sam Levinson? Who knows what film critics should be like more than me, Sam Levinson? It's that kind of thing. Every once in a while, you feel like, wait a second, we're not with these two folks anymore. We're not with these two characters anymore. We're with the director
who's wandered onto the set with a bullhorn
and his pet peeves. And that's where I got really sort of sidetracked in the movie. It looks amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not just the fact that it's in black and white, but it is it's shot entirely in this actual house in Carmel, passing for a Malibu beach house. But the space is utilized so well, the patio, the inside, the downstairs, the upstairs, yeah. And the way that they know how to, you know, like bring it in tight when we need to feel like we're trapped in there, but then also to like give them space when they're pacing around each
right.
other.
Yeah.
On a craft level, this movie is really well put together.
So going back to the original thing we started talking about early on, I don't have an answer anymore for who gets to make what movie. Does a white filmmaker get to write black characters and make that movie? I mean, he did.
Yeah.
So the answer, I guess, is in a technical way, sure, he does.
Yeah.
Should he?
It doesn't sit well with me.
It would be good if stories about black, indigenous, or people of color were created by the same people.
Yeah.
It hasn't been the case historically that this has happened very often at all.
Right.
In the past, you know, let's say 50 years, sure, more. But that's not, you haven't even begun to approach what could be. And so there's always in my head when I see something like this go on, there's this little asterisk in my head. I saw someone on Twitter say, someone black on Twitter said, and I wish I could remember who it was, said, I can tell that a black person is not writing this dialogue. Is not inside these characters.
Sure.
And so I'm a white audience member and I can't tell.
Right.
So I have to trust other people when they say, here's the difference and here's why it's not working for me.
We've certainly seen enough people get gay stuff wrong in movies over years.
That good Lord.
I think it's not a big jump to get there. So,
but I am queer. So yeah, I do see that.
Right.
You know,
well, it's on Netflix. So if you want to see it, it's just there.
Oh, and another thing. These two characters are screaming at each other in the middle of the night. What? Their neighbors would have already called the cops.
There's already a TikTok called like Malcolm and Marie's Neighbors.
Because I guarantee you that there are neighbors somewhere nearby.
Yeah.
Listening to the screaming argument that's
Malibu
happening.
Malibu property
at
lines
3
are
3 a.m. Yeah. Anyway.
We have a sponsor.
Oh, you're right. We do.
Yes.
Hello, Film Movement Plus. You're back. Welcome back.
Hooray.
Film Movement Plus.
Film Movement Plus, an amazing streaming service with narrative documentaries, short films from around the world, critically acclaimed, festival favorites, all the best stuff. Dave, tell us about Coffee with Cinnamon.
No, that's your job.
Well, you're changing it up on me, but fine.
Listen, that's the way it is.
Yeah, clearly. This is a film about Violeta, who lives in Bahia, Brazil. She is dealing with grief and loss. She has a dependent grandmother and a lot of other family issues that she's dealing with, and comes out of her isolation with practical rituals, the scrubbing, the tidying, and most of all, the making of coffee with cinnamon, which I love, by the way.
That's why I threw that title to you.
Oh, I see.
You're the coffee.
Because I would understand.
You're Mr. Coffee Guy.
So this is a film that premiered at Rotterdam and got some really great reviews. And it's now streaming on Film Movement Plus, as is.
It's from filmmakers Ari Rosa and Glenda Nicasio.
Yes. Thank you.
This is a podcast of the cinema.
You're
Alonzo.
Right. You're right.
Yeah.
We need to acknowledge the auteurs and a whole bunch of them involved.
Aria has
in
even
Aria,
more directors.
So many.
Do you remember when this came out?
Oh, yeah.
This was a big art house.
I ran out to see this in the theater.
I did not. I was in Lubbock, Texas, and so it did not play there. But I did see it on VHS.
Well, of course.
With a girlfriend.
No. We all have a past.
Back in the day. Before I learned the ways of Alonzo Duralde's love.
There were some other stops along the way.
Opera arias.
Yes.
Made visual by Robert Altman, Bruce Beresford, Bill Bryden, Jean-Luc Godard, Derek Jarman, Frank Rodham, Nicholas Reg, Nicholas Rogue. I've never said his name out loud. Ken Russell, that's a freak out.
Mm.
Charles Sturridge and Julian Temple.
Yes.
It is clearly non-narrative.
Yeah.
But it is a visual delight.
It's kind of like Art House MTV. These 10 operatic arias put through 10 very different points of view. Obviously, I think if you were making that movie now, you wouldn't have picked 10 white guys. But hey, it was 1989
was
or whatever.
Back in the day
it's how things happen.
Art House was, yeah.
It was the closing night film at Cannes. It has been newly restored from original materials and has screened in recent retrospectives at MoMA, at BAM, and at the Toronto International Film Festival. And it's now on Film Movement Plus.
Tilda Swinton, too.
Yes. And the folks at Film Movement Plus, darlings that they are, have a very special deal for Linoleum Knife listeners. Get a 30-day free trial plus 50% off your first 3 paid months. Use the promo code KNIFE at checkout. That's KNIFE when you go to filmmovementplus.com.
Hey, guess what else?
What else?
There's a Hungarian movie called Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time.
Boy, howdy, is there. Somebody on my Facebook page said, this is like if they took a drama and gave it a giallo title.
Tonight I Will Possess Your Corpse.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's from filmmaker Lily Horvat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's her first film or not, but I haven't seen anything else by her. I know that. It is the story of a woman named Marta,
mm-hmm.
and the actress's name is Natasha Stork. She's a neurosurgeon.
Yes.
And she moves from Hungary to the United States to work, lives there for many years, meets a guy at a neurosurgeon conference.
Right.
He's Hungarian. They make a plan to meet in Budapest at the foot of this bridge.
1 month after their meeting in New Jersey.
Yes. She ditches everything. She doesn't know this guy. She ditches everything. She quits her job. She moves back to Hungary to meet him. She goes to the bridge. He's not there. She begins walking to a car park. She sees him. He says, "I don't know you." Now, guy's played by an actor named Victor Bodo.
Yes.
The rest of the film is... is she stalking him? Or...
is he gaslighting her?
Or... is he a ghost?
That's also a possibility.
Or is he just a hallucination? Or is he real and merely awkward and shy? Or I don't have another or, but you don't know.
No.
You really don't know.
And when it's clear that she has, like, she has given up her job as this very prestigious, you know, like, cutting-edge technology neurosurgeon in New Jersey to come back to this, like, not great hospital in Budapest.
Right.
You know, and everybody thinks that she's, you know, like, what are you even doing? Why are you here? I turned to Dave and I said, is this the plot of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend?
Sort of.
Which we just started watching on Netflix.
But not, because...
no, it's not.
She is, as a character, far more thoughtful and introspective and serious-minded
yes.
about her various life pursuits. Not merely the fact that she's a highly accomplished neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
To the point where it makes the people in this new hospital she's in irritated with her.
Yeah.
Because she's always right.
Ooh, Dr. Fancy Pants is coming sweeping in to tell us hicks that we don't know anything.
Right, right.
Well, you know what? Hicks, you don't know anything.
Well, Budapest doesn't really count as a town of hicks.
Well, I know.
Like,
I'm just...
But these doctors in this hospital...
yes. Are old and set in their ways.
They aren't up on the things she knows.
She's like half of their ages, basically.
Pretty much. So. She's like 40. So not only is she steadfast in the pursuit of, you know, job excellence.
Yeah.
But she is also turning her obsession with this guy in on herself. Like, you can feel her silently, quietly interrogating herself with her therapist.
Right.
Who, you know... isn't really convinced that she has any problem at all, or that maybe this guy even exists. And the film itself is made in such a way that you wonder,
yeah,
if he really exists. I'm not going to give away what comes to pass.
No, I was grabbing the armrest for the last 10 minutes or so.
The last 15 minutes.
And by the armrest, I mean Dave's leg.
I turned to you and I said, if this doesn't work out the way I need it to work out, I'm going to lose my mind. Because I became so invested in the potential tragedy of
yes.
this that I needed the kind of ending I needed it to be.
Yeah.
I didn't want an ambiguous art house ending.
No.
I needed some serious resolution.
Yeah.
I will not tell you if I got that or not. But I will tell you that, first of all, this is fantastic.
Yeah. It's like a romantic mystery.
Yes, it absolutely is. And it's about stuff that films tend not to be about.
Yeah.
It's about the ability to make decisions in the dark. It's about the ability to make life choices when you doubt the nature of what's actually going on in your life, when you don't know what's going on in your life, when even you aren't sure where to step next.
Right.
There's a line of dialogue in the film where the guy she's obsessed with, who is also a neurosurgeon,
Janosch,
he says, you know, the brain is like a city. Some buildings are ugly and you can blow them up. You want to save the beautiful buildings,
yes,
and trash the ones that aren't worth anything.
You can blow up an ugly hotel to save a castle.
Yeah. And what he's getting at is, you know, everything that comes along to you, everything that you take into yourself is not worth taking into yourself. And it might not even be worth investing any of your thought to.
Right.
It might not even be real. There's a quote from Sylvia Plath that begins, there's a title card with,
yes,
with a poem from Sylvia Plath where the very suggestion of the poem is,
I wish I hadn't made you up.
This might not even be happening.
Yeah.
But there is a lot happening here.
Mm-hmm.
I also love the filmmaking style. I love the arrangement of space, because she moves into a garbage apartment just because of a window.
Yeah.
That looks out onto the bridge where she was supposed to meet the guy.
Right.
What kind of... And the bridge is so far off in the distance, you're thinking, honey, you're not going to see him if he shows up on the bridge. You would need like a super powerful telescope. But no, she picks this apartment.
Yeah.
Because it looks at the place that reminds her of the moment when she felt like there might be a chance to love someone.
Yeah.
And that's darker than,
and
than a lot of things.
And don't be misled by the title, which would be perfect for a pandemic movie, but it's,
right,
it is not one. It just sounds like one.
But more, I want to talk more about the spaces in this film, because,
yes,
you know, There is the hospital where, you know, they keep missing each other. There are crowded rooms where they can spy each other from across the crowded room. Maybe that might be the back of his head. It might not be the back of his head. It might be some other guy with a beard. It could be anything.
There's a lot of looking in this movie. There's,
yeah,
a lot of him looking at her and her looking at him. Even like finding old pictures from the conference where they both were in New Jersey. And it's like, she blows up the picture. It's like, oh yeah, it's her looking at him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a moment where they are walking on opposite sides of the streets. And then occasionally on opposite side of the same. Let me spit that back out in English. There's a moment when they are walking on opposite sides of the same street.
Yes.
And then they begin walking backwards a little bit. And then walking forwards a little bit. And again, it's another trigger in your head of, is he there? Are people looking at her walking backwards on the street and wondering, what is she on? You don't know.
There's
a conversation that takes place, maybe, through a closed door.
Right.
We don't even know who's listening on the other side. So there's so much obstacle and barrier and everything going on here.
He even has a book reading. He's written this book, and somebody asks him if he believes in ghosts.
Right. That's not wasted dialogue.
Yeah.
So this film is, again, it's Hungarian.
Yeah.
It is in virtual cinemas. Mm-hmm. If you have an art house in your area, maybe it's there. If it isn't, then you can go to Lemmle, LAEMMLE.com. Mm-hmm. It's there. That's
Los Angeles. Our art house chain in LA.
Yeah, that's Los Angeles' local art house chain. And anyone in any part of the country can access their films.
Yes.
I dig this a lot.
Me too.
And so,
I will be thinking about what that last shot means for a while, I think.
I'm not going to talk about it.
Okay.
Here, because
you can tell me your thoughts afterwards.
Yeah. I think it's in keeping, though, with the rest of the film.
Oh, sure. I just, yeah, you know, I just need to nail down exactly what it's going for. We have some letters.
We have more than some.
Yes.
I'll tell y'all something. We have too many letters. We have so many letters, we're never going to get to all of them. And I'm, I apologize for that now. Y'all are very interactive, and we try to fill, you know, as much space as we can with that interaction. We don't always get a chance to do that. So you've given me a big bunch of them here.
Well, yes.
And because I am the traditional reader of the questions, and because I am also a slow talker, I'm going to try to speed it up.
Okay.
I'm going to try to talk fast.
I want to see how this is going to go.
Or in the words of Pump Up the Volume, talk hard.
Yeah.
Steal the air.
That's right, Dave.
Alex, which is best, boy and his dog movies or boy and his horse movies? Does the equation change if it's specifically a talking dog or a talking horse movie?
I vote boy and his dog. That's generally where my thing goes. I think in the case of either talking dog or talking horse, you can't have a sentimental movie about a talking dog or a talking horse. You can only have a comedy.
You can only have Beverly Hills Chihuahua.
Exactly.
Which is a good movie.
Sure. If you say so.
All right. Here's your answer. I'll tell you the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Girl and Her Horse.
Okay.
Okay. Now, there's a boy in a horse movie, as we all know. Mm-hmm. It's called War Horse, yes. And it's perfect.
Uh-huh.
But Dreamer?
Mm-hmm.
Dakota Fanning and a horse?
Yes.
National Velvet?
Yes.
Baby Elizabeth Taylor?
And a horse.
Dream Horse, which has not come out yet. COVID. Toni Collette and a horse. That's a woman and a horse.
Yes.
But still. These are the best films.
All right.
Dogs. Dogs are great. Everyone loves a dog. But it's the horse movie.
My dog, Skip.
My dog, Skip, is really good.
Oh.
Yeah. the letter continues. Also, you guys kind of have a good boy, bad boy vibe to me sometimes. What? What?
Dare I ask which is which?
Well, here's the assessment.
Okay.
A gayer Grease, if you will. It's so easy to picture Alonzo with his books in a pastel polo and Dave rolling up in a greasy, harsh noise band t-shirt, giving Alonzo one of those looks.
And then lighting a fancy candle.
And then lighting a very fancy candle.
Mm.
So here's the thing about that.
We're both dorks.
If the good boy is like a sarcastic know-it-all who looks askance at people and down his nose at them, sure, Alonzo's a good boy. If the bad boy is someone who admittedly sounds like a bad boy sometimes because of just this genetic anomaly of the way I speak.
It also has a KitchenAid standing mixer.
I have a pink KitchenAid standing mixer. And I use it. I'm not afraid to use it.
That's right.
So,
we contain multitudes, is what we're trying to say.
Yeah, okay, sure. Here we go. Another letter. Jess says, I have never felt more kinship with Alonzo or more vindicated than when he said he didn't like Mystic River. I wanted to take a victory lap around my cul-de-sac. I hated it. Happy 500th episode. This letter is from September.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Jess. We're here for each other.
Millie says, I really enjoy your podcast. The variety and insight to films always paints a beautiful picture in my mind of the film being reviewed. You've opened an entire world of films for me. I recently purchased the... Okay, she says Ovid, but we're going to say Film Movement Plus.
Yes!
Subscription, and I love it. And now I'm dropping Hulu to subscribe to Criterion Channel.
Well.
Thank you. Don't drop Hulu until you watch every season of Letterkenny, please.
Yeah, that's true.
And then every season of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Thank you for many hours of entertaining conversations about a favorite enjoyment of mine.
Thank you. Billy. Thanks, Billy.
Ad? Okay. Jamie says, while I was listening to episode 505, you mentioned the idea that generations are a construct, and I couldn't agree more. This may be because, like you gentlemen, I was born on the cusp of two generations, the tail end of Generation X, but too old to be a millennial. That's friend and neighbor Gary Cotty.
Yeah, an exennial.
Technically, that's me, too. I'm in that weird...
Boomer X.
I'm in that weird, like...
window.
You know, when the... With the what's the
cusp.
Cusp, sure.
The tipping point.
Jamie says, I identify as X, as does my wife, probably because we are both the youngest of our siblings. However, we did recently come across the concept of micro-generations.
Oh?
And found that we most accurately belong to a group called the Oregon Trail Generation, named after the game. Meaning, we had an analog childhood and a digital adulthood. It suits us perfectly. Also, I keep telling my wife that I am a Dave and she is an Alonzo. I would totally buy those matching t-shirts. Okay. I don't know what we are.
Oh, come on. We know couples where we know which one's the Dave and which one's the Alonzo.
Sure. Okay, but you know what? It's only Margie and Robert.
Well, okay. That was the one at the top of my mind, but yeah. I'm sure we can hit with other ones.
So, next one. Craig says, greetings from Sydney, Australia.
Yeah.
I apologize for my poor grammar. It's my first email I've sent to you. I've always wanted to write, but there's been way more important ones that you've received from others. I didn't want to waste your time.
Craig, oh, stop.
Craig.
We love our Antipodean listeners.
You're never wasting our time. Would love my list to be knifed, if you would oblige. These are some great films I've watched since lockdown.
Oh, okay.
Back in March, in no order. Sunrise.
Oh, one of my favorites ever.
Late Spring.
An Ozu I have not seen.
Touch of Evil.
Great.
The Third Man.
Great.
Locke.
Yes.
The Red Shoes.
Not my favorite, but I get it.
That's the one I haven't seen yet.
Oh, okay.
I haven't seen The Red Shoes. Crooklyn.
Love it.
Brief Encounter.
Love it.
Paris, Texas.
Love it.
Blackmail. What is that?
It's an old Hitchcock.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good one.
These are two I haven't seen, but all the rest I have, and they are aces.
Is that the whole list?
100%
knife. 100%
Craig. Knife.
Well done.
Sophie. Says, hope you guys are staying as well as possible under the circumstances. I'm sure you saw that Michael Bay is apparently making a COVID-19 movie. Oh, this came from October. Yep. Yeah, he did
yes.
Make the COVID-19
It was terrible.
it got me to thinking about the ethics of film based on real events in general and where the line is, and whether we in the West draw the line differently based on our proximity to the events in question. In retrospect, it seems absolutely wild that Hotel Rwanda was made just 10 years after the Rwandan genocide. What do you guys think? Is there such a thing as a film being too soon? And if so, where is the line? I have personal opinions about this. You go on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it varies. Obviously, if you're in the case of Michael Bay or somebody who's trying to make a film about the pandemic, they can't pretend to take the whole thing in because it's not over yet.
Right.
But they can at least look at, say, the beginnings of it. And I think we've seen some really interesting films. I thought, you know, Totally Under Control was really powerful. There was a film, In Every Breath, I think, that just premiered at Sundance. It was about sort of the early part of the pandemic and how, like, we saw, you know, governmental misinformation both in China and the US. So, you know, there are ways to address a topic and understand that you're only going to address a piece of the overall thing. But, you know, I think about how it took really, about a 30-year turnover between the end of World War II and really seriously addressing the Holocaust in movies. And then, you know, recently I think we saw like the sort of beginnings of movies that were really trying to deal with what AIDS was like in the 80s, and that was another 30-year cycle. So I don't know if there's a hard and fast rule, but I think obviously there's going to be a difference between something that's sort of a report from the front line as opposed to a sort of measured historical perspective that you can only get in hindsight.
For me, the 9/11 films were all too much too soon.
Yeah.
I couldn't deal with them. There was one that came out in 2002, if you recall. It was an anthology film.
Oh, yeah, 11/9/01.
Yeah. And it was rough. Yeah. I was not ready at all for that.
United 93.
I had a panic attack watching the whole thing. I had to review it. The final scene of United 93, I never want to see. Well, I never want to see that movie again.
Nope.
But I certainly don't want to see that final shot.
No.
Again, because it's
your nightmare.
It's a nightmare. It is my actual nightmare.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there are the 9/11 exploitation films called, like, Remember Me.
Yes.
The Robert Pattinson movie, which is like obscene.
Yeah.
And it's like exploitation of that subject matter. And so, not that he made the movie, he just starred in it, but right. You know what I'm saying. So I have a line. If it upsets me, there's my line. So I think it's everyone has their own, you know.
Yeah, like I didn't hate that 9/11 movie that came out a couple of years ago.
Which one?
The one with Charlie Sheen and Gina Gershon about the people trapped in the elevator in the World Trade Center.
I wouldn't even watch it. I didn't even.
I had to review it, and it was like, you know, there's an idea here, and there's a couple of good performances here. The execution didn't entirely work, but it wasn't on its face, like, you know, reprehensible either.
It's 20 years this year.
Yeah.
Wow. And if someone could convince me that there was something insightful to be had, something insightful about any film about this subject matter, you know, I would consider seeing the film.
Yeah.
It's been 20 years.
Yeah.
So, but boy, up until very recently, no. No, thank you.
Fair enough.
Dylan says, hey, Dave, have you read David Byrne's How Music Works? If not, I really think you'd dig it. Part social history, part biography, part music theory. Lots of fantastic asides. This is a response, I guess, to us talking about the
American Utopia.
American Utopia. Reading him describe the evolution of Talking Heads and his own musical and performance styles gives me a much richer appreciation for the wholeness of what Byrne creates as an artist and of the myriad individual choices that produce that wholeness. It's pretty dense reading, but also the kind of book you can put down and dive right back into a few weeks later. I read it over the course of about a year. Felt exactly right for me. It's great, and so are you guys. Thank you for being wonderful and for doing what you do. Dylan.
Thank you, Dylan.
Marissa. This is the one you told me about. First of all, I just wanted to say congratulations on 10 years of the podcast.
Thank you.
As someone who's been working from a studio apartment since March, your company is much appreciated. I'm a huge Frederick Wiseman fan who spends a lot of time harassing Marty Walsh. Marty Walsh, Mayor Marty, is the mayor of Boston. Well, he's not the mayor of Boston anymore.
He was the mayor of Boston.
He's now in the cabinet.
When City Hall was being made.
Joe Biden. Where he's fixing to be anyway. I spent a lot of time harassing Marty Walsh and being annoyed on city council Zoom calls. So I was excited for this movie to come out, the film City Hall from Frederick Wiseman. Marty Walsh is such a specifically Bostonian politician in that he serves the image of how the world sees Boston, a beacon of progressivism, which is actually the most segregated city in the country. It's a very Kennedy mindset in that once you try to push them at all left of the bare minimum, it comes as an attack. We struggle with the idea of, we're not Republicans, so we're the good ones, without a lot of critical thought toward vulnerable populations. One of my many reactions to Biden's win was, I hope he finds a role for Walsh in his administration to get him out of our hair and get a real progressive who can stand up to the police department and Harvard alike. That's why I think the movie works so well. It reminds you of the scale of the problem of having a politician who raises your blood pressure, but not one you want to see thrown into a gulag. So even though I'm very critical of Walsh, I think it still represents everything I know of Boston so well. The wonderful thing about Wiseman's movies, to me, is that he presents everything so clearly that it can only show what is really happening, which is a functioning, if imperfect, government. It's true that Marty Walsh is a good guy who works incredibly hard. It's equally true that a working government means I can live here my whole life and continue to be a pain in the butt at city council meetings. I also just wanted to let you know that his nickname in my social circus... His nickname in my social circles is Farty Walsh.
I mean, that's fatty.
Which has brought us all joy in quarantine. If any of your listeners are so inclined, there are two nonprofit indie Boston area cinemas which are showing City Hall in their virtual theaters, the Coolidge and the Brattle.
The Brattle. Nice. And yes, Biden has appointed Marty Walsh to be the new Secretary of Labor.
Jay says, a few weeks ago, Hu Hsiao-hsien received the Lifetime Achievement Award at the 57th Taipei Golden Horse Film Festival.
Yeah.
Hu Hsiao-hsien was in a leadership position for years with the Golden Horse Film Fest, but since he stepped down, they can finally give him a much-deserved Lifetime Achievement Award. To illustrate what a big deal this is, director Hirokazu Koreeda, 2018's Shoplifters, flew to Taiwan and quarantined for 2 weeks just to introduce the award to Hu Hsiao-hsien, saying at the ceremony, "We are not related by blood, but I feel like I am a son of his."
Wow.
The trophy itself was handed to Hu Hsiao-hsien by his longtime cinematographer, Mark Lee Ping Bin, jury president of the film fest, and cinematographer of Flowers of Shanghai and The Assassin, and also Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love, at least part-time, with Doyle. I thought I would mention this as well, since it was mentioned in the comment above. You can watch the award clip here. Sends a YouTube link. Unfortunately, there are no English subtitles, but it's still a great moment to watch. And you can also see a pre-award video with Ho chatting with his assassin and my favorite three-time stars, Xu Qi and Chang Chen. Also, you can catch a masked Ang Lee in the audience. He currently serves as the film festival chairman and apparently just finished his quarantining the day before the awards ceremony. I hope you enjoy The Time to Live and The Time to Die, Alonso. Oh, he will.
Haven't gotten there yet. We'll keep you posted.
He will.
Don't go speaking for me.
My email is being weird. And it's making me, instead of scroll down, it's making me pop back out and scroll back down to find all the emails again. I apologize for that. It's being very weird. JD says, I definitely had a mixed response to Promising Young Woman. I ended up watching some online videos afterwards with Emerald Fennell and the cast talking about the why of some of the film's choices. I think the director was more interested in provoking the argument afterwards rather than trying to answer a question in the film itself. That's sort of my feeling as well. Which may or not be the right choice, but I definitely liked it better once I understood that my frustration was the intended effect.
You win, Emerald Fennell.
Robert Kirby.
Oh.
Cool cartoonist Robert Kirby.
Yes, check out his Patreon page.
Thank you so much for reviewing What Happened Was. This blew me away back in 1994. So excellent. Should have been a much bigger indie success. Time to watch it again.
Yes, and it has lost none of its oomph.
I do not need to watch it again. It's too upsetting for me.
But 27 years between watching was about right.
Nikki has an answer for a question.
Oh?
I think the little white gumballs were from Origins.
Oh, you know what? That sounds right, actually.
The mall store Origins. Yes. It's all lots of body creams and things.
Yes. Yeah.
They're super minty. Chalky, but it might help your sinuses. It's some kind of aromatherapy thing. Are you sure the Aveda guy wasn't selling you wheatgrass? You know, it might have been wheatgrass, but he didn't call it that. He said,
it's wellness.
It's wellness.
Yes.
Wish I knew where that guy was. We should be friends.
Have him on the show.
Yeah. Wheatgrass shots were a thing, and they sound kind of similar. Also, I haven't been in a mall in a year either, but Aveda is sure marketing to me online all the time, so they are definitely alive and kicking.
Yeah, I got Dave like two little Clinique things for his Christmas stocking, and the emails every day.
Yeah. Clinique for men.
Yes.
It's very masculine.
Oh, yeah.
These are eye treatments.
Butchneek.
Some of us have puffy, baggy eyes, and we need help. We need help with Clinique for Men eye treatments.
We need products and ointments and unguents and salves and poultices.
Amber Petty. A letter, not an ad.
Oh.
Yeah. My friends had a baking club before the pandemic. Every month they gave a theme. Cakes, Christmas cookies. Then people brought their baked goods and enjoyed. So a baking club is totally possible and a great idea when the pandemic is over. I know. I think it's such a great idea.
I love it. Because I'll just be here and eat all the things.
Thomas. On your discussion of violence against women. Perhaps this comment is a little feminism 101, but I think that what you're discussing is a much wider cultural issue than just that of film. Well, I mean, yes, sure. Of course. I think as a society, we enjoy and have enjoyed for a long time depictions of women when they are simultaneously beautiful and incapacitated or dead.
Ooh.
While listening to your talk, I was thinking about the fairy tales that feature this trope, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. The fashion spreads that depict models as beautiful broken corpses, the comics and TV shows where the audience is invited to gaze over pristine women in hospital beds and morgues. Even figures like Marilyn Monroe are in some way seen to have been preserved through death, kept young and beautiful for us as the general public because we never had to witness her grow old. I think that there's a very dark part of our collective imagination that either sees women as best when they are incredibly beautiful, but unable to exert any agency at all, or which treats them as literal objects, best to be kept for as long as they are attractive and disposed of in order to preserve this attractiveness. I guess in some ways this is just an extreme conclusion of a misogynist mindset. Anyway, I thought your discussion of this film was interesting, but that this is a much wider issue, that we still have a long way to go as a culture if we're going to fully uproot it. Yep. I agree with you, Thomas.
For sure.
And now I have to close it back out and go back down again. Sorry. But here we are, maybe soon. Why does Williams-Sonoma keep bothering me so much?
Oh, they are aggressive.
I've gotten to the last letter. We got it all the way.
Wow, look at us. Okay.
Gentlemen, this is from Douglas. After reading the excellent article in the New York Times by Timothy Snyder about authoritarian culture and what's happening in the Republican Party,
yes,
the people who want to game the system and the people who want to break the system and how they are at odds, and how the population is similar the conservative population.
Right.
He says, I began reflecting on my own understanding of fascist and communist authoritarian propaganda media. This led me to thinking about how Davis pointed out many times, too many times, that the evangelical films that have come out in the past several years aren't very good, but they have a fervent base audience. While I have not viewed these films all the way through, for many different reasons, I'm curious if you, as critics, might connect these films to authoritarian ideas. Oh, Douglas,
in a heartbeat.
Absolutely, 100%, yes. They very much advance the patriarchy. I know that they speak of unquestioning belief and the fact that those who are not Christian, in quotes, are dealt with harshly. Have films like God's Not Dead, Left Behind, and I would go out on the limb and add Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, actually introduced and reinforced the ideas of authoritarianism. Besides being evangelical Christian propaganda, are they also political authoritarian propaganda? Answer, yes.
Boy, howdy.
They are, because those two things go hand in hand. And you've heard me talk about this too many times. But yes, absolutely. That's why the modern evangelical church in the United States is so inextricably entwined with Trump and QAnon and conspiracies and guns and you name
the Republican Party.
You name something destructive and anti-Christian, and they love it.
Yeah.
Go figure that out. Go figure that out. Mm. We'll talk again in 35 years when you figure it out. I certainly can't.
Right.
And now we're done.
All righty. Well, thank you, everybody, for all your letters. And, you know, you can always drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We don't promise we'll get to it, but we do love hearing from you, and we'll give it our best shot. Hey, check out our friends on the internet. Go see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to over at Critically Acclaimed. Check out the Schmoes Know. Dennis, with Dennis Hensley, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, Secretly Timid, All Things Cozy, Big Fat Gay Podcast, Criterion Cast.
Do you even remember all of them?
And Fat Guys at the Movies. I usually do. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review. We will certainly read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, CastBox, Podbean, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon Music, all the places. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Follow him on Twitter for updates at Bluetopia, BLEUTOPIA. Follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And thank you for listening. We will be back next time. Oh, we have a Patreon page. Patreon.com / Linoleum Knife. It's, lots of extra shows.
It's very important.
Lots of extra content. You might like it. You never know. And yeah, until next time.
Goodbye.